evening, everyone. This is Lou Caverly, and you're listening to the Divided Kingdom radio show. Well, we have several items today that have to do with the Supreme Court rulings, and I think we can say that these particular ones are favorable from our point of view. And if you want to hear past programs, this is a good time to say that. Visit our archives. Our website is DividedKingdomRadio.com, DividedKingdomRadio.com. And you can hear programs from the past just by going to our archives on that website. Usually, the programs are uploaded within a day or two of the broadcast. And this program is broadcast Thursday evenings at WWCR.com at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and on their shortwave at 4.840 megahertz at 8 p.m. on Thursdays. But you can hear it from the archives anytime. It also repeats on WWCR on a frequency of 7.490 on Saturday mornings at 8 a.m., again, Eastern Time. Well, let's begin with an article that appeared in the LifeSite News just a few days back, Friday, June 27th, 2025, by Calvin Freeberger. Supreme Court rules parents can opt children out of LGBT books. This one was of particular interest to me because it concerns Montgomery County, Maryland, which is one of the big suburbs of Washington, D.C. Most of you have heard of Bethesda Naval Hospital. That's located in Montgomery County. And I lived for about 15 years in this next-door county, Prince George's County, Maryland, also a suburb that borders Washington, D.C. And the summary subheadline reads, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 in favor of Maryland parents seeking to opt their children out of school lessons featuring pro-LGBT books, and a major victory for parents' rights. Dateline, Washington, D.C., again from the LifeSite News, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 6-3 on Friday in favor of parents opting their children out of school lessons featuring pro-LGBT indoctrination over the objections of a Maryland school board. Mahmoud versus Taylor, that was the name of the court case, concerns Montgomery County Public Schools, MCPS, mandating a list of LGBT reading materials for children in kindergarten through fifth grade, including Prince and Knight, a fairy tale about a male knight and a prince who get quote-unquote married. Also a book on 50 LGBTQ plus historical figures titled Rainbow Revolutionaries, including accused child abuser Harvey Milk, and the pro-transgender book Born Ready, the true story of a boy named Penelope. And again, keep in mind, this is Lou speaking now, we're talking here about books for children from kindergarten through fifth grade. We're not talking high school books. We're talking little kids being indoctrinated, being brainwashed, you might say, with this kind of thing. I don't remember any books about heterosexual practices being foisted on students, and yet these homosexual books are being foisted on them, or at least the attempt is being made and has been made to foist them on the kids all over the place in this country. Now, going on with the article, the district initially allowed parents to opt out, but soon reversed itself in the name of fostering, quote, inclusive and safe spaces for students, unquote. Last May, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals denied the parents' request for a preliminary injunction while their lawsuit proceeds. As LifeSite News reported previously, in 2020, Montgomery County Public Schools became the first school district in the country to introduce an, quote, LGBTQ studies, unquote, course, which is now offered at several high schools in the district. The current curriculum for the course was written by homosexual and transgender students and members of a local LGBT activist group. MCPS includes LGBTQ references, that's in quotes, LGBTQ references in high school U.S. history classes as well. The district, which celebrates Pride Month, has also performed audits to promote and this is again in quotes, LGBTQ-related content and examples in math, science, and social studies classes, including for grades K through 5, according to a Montgomery County Public Schools presentation from 2020. All right, I'm going to introduce something here. This is Lou interjecting. I taught math for the better part of 45 years. I don't remember anywhere that the topic of sexuality, gender, ever even was appropriate, ever even came up in math topics. So the fact that you would introduce that in, say, a math class means that obviously this is an agenda trying to push something down the throats of students. It's not the natural thing that you would cover in something like a math class. But going on with the article, the presentation notes that MCPS has partnered with the Human Rights Campaign, the largest pro-LGBT pressure group in the United States, and an outspoken supporter of, quote, sex changes, unquote, for children. The nation's highest court agreed in January to hear Mahmoud versus Taylor and has now ruled in favor of parental rights in a majority opinion written by conservative Justice Samuel Alito that the parents are entitled to a preliminary injunction against forcing their children to partake in the books, agreeing they are, quote, likely to succeed on the merits, they are likely to suffer irreparable harm in the absence of preliminary relief. The balance of equities tips in their favor, that would be the parents, and an injunction would be in the public interest. It goes on to say, a government burdens the religious exercise of parents when it requires them to submit their children to instruction that poses a, quote, very real threat of undermining the religious beliefs and practices that the parents wish to instill, unquote. And those are the words of Justice Alito, again, who wrote the majority opinion. And it goes on to say, and a government cannot condition the benefits of free public education on parents' acceptance of such instruction, unquote. And he explains the practice of educating one's children and one's religious beliefs, like all religious acts and practices, receives a generous measure of protection from our Constitution. And this is not merely a right to teach religion in the confines of one's own home. Rather, it extends to the choices that parents wish to make for their children outside the home. It protects, for example, a parent's decision to send his or her child to a private religious school instead of a public school. The quote goes on, due to financial and other constraints, however, many parents have no choice but to send their children to a public school. As a result, the right of parents to direct the religious upbringing of their children would be an empty promise if it did not follow those children into the public school classroom. We have thus recognized limits of the government's ability to interfere with the student's religious upbringing in a public school setting, unquote. And left-wing Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a dissenting opinion joined with the court's most liberal wing, arguing that the vision of public schools as places of, quote, opportunity to practice living in a multicultural society will become a mere memory if children must be insulated from exposure to ideas and concepts that may conflict with their parents' religious beliefs, unquote. And she lamented, today's ruling ushers in that new reality, casting aside long-standing precedent the court invents a constitutional right to avoid exposure to subtle themes contrary to the religious principles that parents wish to instill in their children. Unquote. Sotomayor decried that the ruling would restrict exposing children to pro-LGBT messaging, such as that LGBTQ people exist, and the celebration of homosexual and gender-confused individuals, marriages, and life events, unquote. The ruling represents a win for parental rights. Liberty Council celebrated. Concerned Women for America called it a common-sense victory for parental rights over the ability to opt their children out of instruction using LGBTQ-plus-themed storybooks. Well, that's pretty much it for that article. So that's a win for parents' rights. And to me, common sense. Well, now here we have another. And by the way, that one was from LifeSite News, dated Friday, June 27th. Supreme Court rules parents can opt children out of LGBT books. Then going back about a week and a half, we had a ruling also covered in the LifeSite News that reads, Supreme Court rules, states can protect children from gender transitions in a landmark decision. This was by Doug Mainwaring, Wednesday, June 18th. LifeSite News, Dateline, Washington, D.C. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a landmark decision this morning upholding Tennessee's law protecting minors from undergoing so-called gender transitions, including surgeries and puberty blocking or cross-sex hormone drugs for children under age 18. The court rejected a challenge to the volunteer state's law launched by three families and a physician joined by the Biden administration, who had claimed that Tennessee had violated the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection under the law. And John Henry Weston, who I believe is the founder of LifeSite News, his Twitter account said this, breaking, in a 6-3 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court affirms that states may lawfully block sex transition procedures on minors. The tide is turning against mutilation masquerading as medicine. Well, I think I would agree with exactly what he said. Back to the article. The measure, which has sailed through the Tennessee House in a sweeping 77-16 vote, was signed into law by Governor Bill Lee in 2023. It states explicitly that, quote, a health care provider shall not knowingly perform or offer to perform on a minor or administer or offer to administer to a minor a medical procedure if the performance or administration of the procedure is for the purpose of A, enabling a minor to identify with or live as a purported identity inconsistent with a minor's sex, or B, treating purported discomfort or distress from a discordance between the minor's sex and the asserted identity, unquote. More than 20 states have passed similar laws. Excellent news, Representative Ryan Anderson, Ethics and Public Policy Center President and member of President Donald Trump's newly established Religious Liberty Commission. And he went on to say, SCOTUS just ruled 6-3 that states can protect children from sex-rejecting transition procedures, unquote. And Chloe Cole wrote on X, my heart is overflowing with gratitude. Every child in America is now safer. And she said, thank you to the state of Tennessee, the parents who never backed down, and every detransitioner who shared the truth, said Ms. Cole, who was herself a young detransitioner. And she went on to say, this victory is ours. The Texas Attorney General wrote, landmark victory for Tennessee and SCOTUS in defense of America's children. And we have a couple of other comments. Well, first, it says all six Republican-appointed judges comprise the majority, while Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson dissent. And let's see now. Next are the words of Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote in the majority, quote, "This case carries with it the weight of fierce scientific and policy debates about the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving field." And noted Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, he said, "The voices in these debates raise sincere concerns. The implications for all are profound. The Equal Protection Clause does not resolve these disagreements, nor does it afford us license to decide them as we see best. Our role is not to judge the wisdom, fairness, or logic of the law before us," said Justice Roberts, "but only to ensure that it does not violate the equal protection guarantee of the 14th Amendment. Having concluded it does not, that is, does not violate it, we leave questions regarding its policy to the people, their elected representatives, and the democratic process," he concluded. All right, so that's another win for those of us who think parents should have some rights, and these agenda-driven medical procedures that put children at high risk should not be allowed. Now, we move to the Washington Times, and again, that was from LifeSite News on June 18th. And now, just a couple of days ago, the Washington Times, "Trump celebrates monumental win at the Supreme Court." Still another decision. This is by Stephen Dinan. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. D-I-N-A-N. The Washington Times, Friday, June 27th, 2025. "President Trump heaped praise on the Supreme Court Friday, thanking the justices for a, quote, monumental, unquote, ruling that limits the power of lower court judges to issue universal blockades on his executive actions. Said Mr. Trump, this brings back the Constitution. There are people elated all over the country," unquote. He called the injunctions a grave threat to democracy, saying individual judges used injunctions to tie up presidential powers for years. And the president also said, "I'm grateful to the Supreme Court for stepping in and solving this very big, complex problem," unquote. He had particular praise for Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who wrote the majority opinion in the 6-3 ruling. She was Mr. Trump's last appointee to the High Court in his first term, but has been facing growing complaints among some conservative legal scholars and the MAGA movement. Mr. Trump, however, said, "I have great respect for her. Her decision was brilliantly written today from all accounts." Justice Barrett, in her opinion, said universal injunctions have threatened to create an imperial judiciary. He also praised the court for another ruling Friday that blocked a policy in Montgomery County, Maryland. And I won't read all that because we just got through talking about that. Mr. Trump said the parents deserved the court's decision. He also said they lost control of these schools. They lost control of their child. So, and in a similar note, again, that was the Washington Times, Friday, June 27th. And that same day, from the New York Post, talking about the same thing, we had an editorial. "The Supreme Court was entirely right to slap down lower court federal judges who keep trying to play king. Hail to the Supreme Court for definitively slapping down the lower court judges who've been issuing nationwide injunctions against President Donald Trump's orders and actions. Though the case touched on birthright citizenship, the court didn't remotely decide that question, nor even offer much hint of how they will eventually come down on it. Rather, the court announced that the nation's 1,000-plus federal district court judges can no longer routinely stop the executive branch dead in its tracks. Their rulings can only apply to the plaintiff's actual representatives in the case. Though the door is still open to much broader rulings if the litigants do what's necessary to get certified for a class action case. But no longer can a single trial court federal judge in Oregon, Rhode Island, or wherever put on hold a president's order to, say, stop billions in spending across the country. This is a win, not just for Trump, but for the presidency itself and for the voters of America who elected an executive to institute policy. In just 5 months, Trump has been slapped with at least 25 national injunctions on everything from spending reforms to education policy and deportation policies. It's a practice without precedent until recent years, though the shoe was on the other foot in the Biden and Obama eras. Which is why Justice Elena Kagan, one of the three dissenters in Friday's ruling in the past, has decried, quote, all kinds of abuses of nationwide injunctions, unquote. Yet Democrats and the three left-wing justices are again screaming about authoritarian rule and the end of democracy, with Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson insisting, quote, everyone from the president on down is bound by law, unquote. Which is true, as Justice Amy Coney Barrett noted in her opinion, except, quote, that goes for judges too, unquote. In other words, quote, Justice Jackson decries an imperial executive while embracing an imperial judiciary, unquote. Exactly. It's up to the Supreme Court to issue national rulings on such constitutional issues. The lower courts should restrict themselves to the litigants standing before them. No kings must apply to these judges, too. Very good editorial from the New York Post, June 27th. Now we move on to a topic we've talked about many a time, but a couple articles having to do with so-called vaccines. The first one from Slate News, also June 27th, 2025, by Frank Bergman. Japan ends mandatory child, quote-unquote, vaccines. Sudden infant deaths disappear. A leading American physician has issued an alarming wake-up call to Western nations by warning that Japan's sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, crisis disappeared as soon as the government ended the country's mandatory vaccine schedule. And as it often is in these articles, the word vaccine is in quotes because we're talking here about some of the newer ones that are not traditional vaccines in the first place. Back to the article. According to Dr. Pierre Kory, and that's spelled K-O-R-Y, quote, neonatal mortality decrease, unquote, when the government stopped mandating vaccines for children under two. Dr. Kory is the former chief of the critical care service and medical director of the Trauma and Life Support Center at the University of Wisconsin. Kory, a specialist in medicine and pulmonary and critical care, is also the president and chief medical officer of the Frontline Critical Care Alliance. During an interview with CHD, Kory linked the practice of vaccinating babies in Western countries to surging SIDS cases. And again, that's sudden infant death syndrome. Kory began, quote, this actually happened in Japan. He went on, I think this is really interesting because you look at how these two countries, that is America and Japan, behave toward vaccines and vaccine safety. And Japan has done really some actions which are not followed by a lot of other Western advanced health economies. But when they noticed this rash of deaths in the 70s, they saw what they did is they raised the age of vaccination to 2 years old. Guess what happened when they did that? Kory asked. Infant deaths disappeared. And these are, again, quotations from Dr. Kari. You know, so you have a country who noticed the signal, did something about it, and actually solved a problem. Neonatal mortality decreased, he asserted. Sudden infant deaths were surging in Japan during the 1970s and continued through the 80s and 90s. In 1994, the Japanese government changed vaccination laws to make child vaccines optional instead of mandatory. Shortly after the change was made, infant deaths plunged. The warning from Dr. Kari comes amid growing concerns regarding the emerging links between vaccines and SIDS, again, that sudden infant death syndrome. As Slate News recently reported, a leading pediatrician has also been sounding the alarm about childhood vaccinations. Dr. Paul Thomas is warning that children are more likely, and these are his words, are more likely to die from the vaccine than from the disease itself, unquote. Dr. Thomas recently went on the record to warn the public that vaccines cause a vast majority of sudden deaths in young children and babies. After witnessing an alarming surge in sudden infant death syndrome, Dr. Thomas has blown the whistle on the cause of this chilling spike in mortality. During an interview with CHDTV, Thomas revealed that a staggering 97% of all sudden infant deaths happened within 10 days of the child being vaccinated. He notes that the remaining 3% of sudden infant deaths happened between 10 and 20 days after vaccination. Many would argue that these findings show that vaccines cause 100% of SIDS cases. SIDS is sudden infant death syndrome, Thomas explains. He went on, there are six data set studies that look at SIDS when that infant died relative to when they got a vaccine. In one data set, 97% were in the first 10 days after the vaccine. Only 3% were in the subsequent 10 days, he notes. And he has a few other statistics. I won't read all that now. But the conclusions seem quite clear. That, again, was from Slate News, June 27th. Now, another item having to do with vaccines is from LifeSite News. Headline reads, mother of four-year-old sues West Virginia for mandating vaccines, denying religious exemption. This is by Matt Lamb. Again, LifeSite News, Friday, June 27th. The West Virginia Education Department is facing a lawsuit after trying to force a four-year-old to take abortion-tainted shots in order to attend school. The parent suing, Miranda Guzman, has the backing of the state's governor. Guzman's lawsuit, provided via News and Sentinel, names the West Virginia Board of Education, the state superintendent of schools, the Raleigh County Board of Education, and the county superintendent of schools. Guzman, quote, maintains profound religious objections to injecting her four-year-old child, AG, with the vaccination required, the lawsuit states. While West Virginia has strict obstacles to getting an exemption, Governor Patrick Morrissey released an executive order requiring an opportunity to request a religious exemption. It follows a 2023 state law called the West Virginia Equal Protection for Religion Act, which generally protects the religious liberties of West Virginia residents. The State Department of Health granted the Guzman family an exemption, but Raleigh County schools refused to honor it. Even further, the State Board of Education ordered school districts to ignore Governor Morrissey's lawful order and thus continue to coerce parents into getting their children jabbed. Despite being a deep red Republican state, West Virginia, quote, is a radical outlier from the rest of the country in that its sports vaccination law only allows secular medical exemptions and disallows religious exemptions, according to the lawsuit. State leaders are backing Ms. Guzman's legal suit. And skipping down just a bit, the state's top health official also backs the exemption. So you see, this is myself, Lou, interjecting. It seems that the medical people back this woman in her desire not to have the child vaccinated with this abortion-tainted so-called vaccine. But for some reason, the school board, statewide and local, is flying in the face of the medical establishment. So that's something I really can't understand. But I'm going to jump down now just to a couple of the headlines, or I should say the key points. It says the lawsuit is the latest battle in the state between supporters of medical freedom who stress that parents and individuals have a right to decline jabs and those who want to coerce students into taking vaccines regardless of risk. The News and Sentinel, I guess that's the local paper, reports, in May, the governor's office released guidelines to schools and parents seeking vaccine exemptions. The State Department of Education had also released a memo to county school superintendents ordering them to follow the state vaccination law, but walked that memo back due to pressure from the governor's office. And so on. Well, we'll have to see how that comes out, which is still in the courts. But again, that's from LifeSite News, mother of four-year-old Sue's West Virginia, etc. Friday, June 27th. All right, now, on a whole different topic, we've heard a lot about anti-Semitism lately. Here's somebody from the Washington Times, June 25th, by Valerie Richardson. Lawsuit rips MIT for becoming breeding ground for anti-Semitism. I should mention, before I read the article, I worked as a boy, well, not exactly a boy, in my upper teens, very early 20s, some summer jobs at MIT. My dad was proud to be a machinist at one of the labs associated with MIT, and mine was a pretty low-level job, changing light bulbs, that kind of thing, but I was always kind of proud to have said I worked a little bit at MIT. I know my dad loved the job and retired from there. And I never thought it would come to this. Never thought. I always thought MIT was an institution that welcomed all people with no discrimination. But here it is. Lawsuit rips MIT for becoming breeding ground for anti-Semitism. Again, Washington Times, Wednesday, June 25th. A lawsuit filed Wednesday against the Massachusetts Institute of Technology accused university officials of, quote, standing idly by, unquote, as the campus became a hotbed of anti-Semitism, prompting a Jewish graduate student to abandon his PhD program in the face of relentless harassment. The Brandeis Center Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism, whose members include MIT faculty, students, and alumni, said MIT president, Sally Kornbluth's lack of decisive action permitted anti-Semitism to, quote, dominate campus life for Jews and Israelis following the October 7th, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. And Brandeis is, of course, another university in Massachusetts. I believe it's in Waltham, suburban Boston. Back to the article. The complaint cited incidents, including campus protests calling for violence against Jews worldwide, celebrations of the Hamas attack, classes interrupted with anti-Semitic chants, Jewish and Israeli students blocked from certain areas of campus, and, quote, terror maps, unquote, pinpointing Jewish gathering spots. The coalition sued MIT and Michael DeGraff, a tenured linguistics professor, accused of harassing and endangering an Israeli faculty member and a Jewish student by targeting them on social media and in emails. Quote, and these are the words of the lawsuit, in the absence of moral leadership and meaningful action, the MIT campus was turned into a breeding ground of anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli hate and hostility that emboldened students and professors to harass and discriminate against Jews and Israelis without restraint, said the lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court for Massachusetts. Kenneth Marcus, Brandeis Center Chairman and former Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights in the first Trump administration, called MIT's handling of campus anti-Semitism, quote, a textbook example of neglect and indifference, unquote. And he said in a statement, not only were several anti-Semitic incidents conducted at the hands of a professor, but MIT's administration refused to take action on every single occasion. The very people who are tasked with protecting students are not only failing them, but are the ones attacking them, unquote. The center, and again, that would be the Brandeis Center Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism, settled a lawsuit in January against Harvard, in which the university agreed to adopt the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, recognize Zionism as central to Jewish identity, and explicitly make targeting Jews and Zionists a violation of school rules. And here we have a quote from Mr. Marcus. In order to eradicate hate from campuses, we must hold faculty and the university administration responsible for their participation in, and in this case, their proliferation of anti-Semitism and abuse, said Mr. Marcus. In addition to the coalition, the named plaintiffs of the MIT lawsuit are math instructor Leah Alon, A-L-O-N, and former PhD computer science student William Sussman, who said university officials failed to protect. These people said the university officials failed to protect them from harassment by Mr. DeGraff. Both have also sued DeGraff for defamation. In a statement, the university said it will, quote, defend itself in court regarding the allegations raised in the lawsuit. To be clear, MIT rejects anti-Semitism. As President Kornbluth has said, anti-Semitism is real and it is rising in the world. We cannot let it poison our community. Well, the article goes on to describe some of the incidents they're referring to by this one professor who attacked both a student and another professor, which is the at the heart of this lawsuit, these anti-Semitic allegations. And the it says Mr. Alon, one of the plaintiffs in the case, sent an email to Ms. Kornbluth, the MIT president, detailing the harassment, but she never responded, the lawsuit said. And it says, as a result, Mr. Long said he was confronted by hostile strangers in various public locations, prompting him to move his child to an off-campus daycare. He has applied for more than 50 tenure-track positions at other institutions, but has been rejected. The lawsuit said, the quote, the anti-Semitic public exposure Long was subjected to has also impacted his search for a position as a tenured professor. Despite his extraordinary academic research and professional credentials, he was denied positions again and again that a candidate with his credentials would otherwise have been offered, unquote. The lawsuit said Mr. Sussman, and he was the graduate student, left the PhD program in January after being targeted by the Professor DeGraff. And it goes on with some other details, but I won't go into here. But, again, college campuses, as we've read about, heard about, seen on TV, have been hotbeds for anti-Semitic riots, protests, intimidation. something that should never been allowed. It's in the smacks of the early days of Nazi Germany. And thankfully, Mr. Trump has come out in opposition to those anti-Semitic protests. All right, next. And again, that was from the Washington Times. The date for that article about MIT was June 25th of this year. Now, another action by the Trump administration from LifeSite News. Trump's Department of Education replaces Pride Month with Title IX Month about protecting girls. The subheadline reads, Trump's Education Department is dropping LGBT Pride celebrations this month, instead declaring June Title IX Month and dedicating it to protecting female sports and spaces. This is by Kelvin Freeberger, again from LifeSite News, Tuesday, June 3rd, 2023. As June begins, the U.S. Department of Education, DOE, under the Trump administration is celebrating Title IX Month instead of LGBT Pride Month, putting the focus on historic legislation protecting the rights of actual females. The Daily Wire reports that DOE, quote, will spend June highlighting the Trump administration's actions taken to protect female sports and spaces, as well as reversing the weaponization of Title IX that took place during the previous administration, unquote. It will also launch investigations of the University of Wyoming, letting a gender-confused male into the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority chapter, including letting him live in female-only campus housing, and Colorado's Jefferson County Public Schools for forcing a young girl to share a bed with a trans-identifying boy on an overnight school trip. Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 provides a long-standing set of rules against sex discrimination in public education. In 2021, former President Joe Biden's DOE issued a guidance to educators that its Office for Civil Rights interpreted Title IX to also cover, quote, sexual orientation and gender identity, unquote, and would, quote, forcefully enforce this interpretation in education programs and activities that receive federal financial assistance from the department, unquote. In 2024, a finalized Title IX rule expanded the federal government's prohibition against, quote unquote, discrimination to include under its umbrella so-called, quote, discrimination based on sex stereotypes, sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics, unquote. The change, which had broad ramifications for sex-specific restrooms, lockers, and athletic programs, speech and conscience rights, provoked numerous lawsuits and rulings against the administration. And upon returning to power, the Trump administration restored a biology-based understanding of sex to Title IX, including threatening to withhold federal funds from states who cling to transgender policies that negatively impact real females. The Trump administration has also ended recognition of LGBT pride, pride in quotes, in the military, FBI, Kennedy Center, and more. Many are currently watching with great interest to see if the private sector embraces Pride Month as fully as it has in the past, given the widespread backlash to woke ideology. All right, that again was from LifeSite News on June 3rd. That's a few weeks old now, but the topics are still very relevant. I don't know about that last statement, whether the private sector has embraced Pride Month with quite the enthusiasm that it had in the past. I do know locally there were a couple of pride parades in a couple of the little towns near where I live. And let me say this. As far as this whole matter of Title IX goes, I'm old enough to remember when Title IX came in. And for the first time, a lot of girls' sports received a fair amount of the money from colleges that, you know, were, for a long time, the girls' sports were sort of second-class citizens. They got only a tiny fraction of what the men's sports got, under the theory that the men's brought in the most money. So Title IX, and that would have been, I believe, during the Nixon administration, one of the better things he did, or at least the Congress at the time, and that he signed. Title IX tried to increase fairness for the girls. And for a long time, I think it did that. And then you had these people coming in who said, well, if a man thinks he's a woman, or says he thinks he's a woman, he ought to be able to participate in the women's sports. That, to me, is an asinine, stupid, ignorant idea. And for most Americans, that's what they think, too. How do you put up a man, even if he claims he's a woman, against a smaller woman in combat sports, in things like wrestling, in things like boxing? And that happened in one of the incidents, I think it was last year. The girl simply couldn't compete against the man because he was bigger. He said he was a woman, but he was bigger, stronger, had a longer reach. No wonder she couldn't compete. The best woman. And that same man, if he had competed, and I think he did at one point, against other men, would have been way down the list. Wouldn't have been really a competitor at all. So this is good. This restores common sense and sanity to this whole matter of women's sports. And I don't see that any sensible thinking person can see it any other way. Maybe I'm just a little bit old-fashioned, but I don't think so. Most Americans side with me. All right, and in a closely related article, this one also from LifeSite News, June 25th, by the California Family Council. The headline reads, Pro-Family Advocates Celebrate Landmark Victory for Female Athletes in California. Again, this is written by the California Family Council. California Family Council, CFC, applauds the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights for officially concluding that both the California Department of Education and the California Interscholastic Federation are in violation of Title IX for policies that discriminate against female athletes by allowing male athletes to compete in girls' sports. Excuse me. For the past 2 years, California Family Council has faithfully attended CIF, and CIF is California Interscholastic Federation meetings, raising repeated concerns and urging officials to align their policies with federal Title IX requirements. Last Friday, June 20th, CFC's outreach director, Sophia Laurie, hosted a press conference alongside female athletes and their families outside the CIF executive meeting in Costa Mesa, California. They then hand-delivered a petition to CIF signed by 20,074 individuals, including 41 states, and national organizations, and eight California legislators, calling on the CIF officials to stop allowing males to compete in girls' athletics. Today's findings are a landmark victory for female athletes across California who have been forced to compete on an unequal playing field, one that undermines both their safety and hard-earned achievements. And said Sophia Laurie, girls' sports advocate for California Family Council, quote, as a former CIF athlete and collegiate athlete in California, I am deeply grateful to see the U.S. Department of Education taking action. I've personally heard from too many young women who have faced the injustice of being forced to compete against male athletes, losing out on championships, awards, and their right to safety. Title IX was designed to protect women like them, like me, and like the next generation of girls coming up in sports. This decision is a critical step toward restoring fairness and protecting the integrity of girls' sports in our state. We urge the California Department of Education and CIF to comply immediately and put our daughters first, unquote. Well, that certainly sounds like good sense to me. There's a little bit more, but we're getting short on time, so I'll stop there. If you want to read the whole thing, go to LifeSite News, Wednesday, June 25th, 2025. The headline was Pro-Family Advocates Celebrate Landmark Victory for Female Athletes in California. And now we have an article from the New York Post by Miranda Devine. Trump derangement syndrome drives deep state leakers. CNN, the treasonous links to deny the pres a victory. Again, this is June 25th by Miranda Devine. How deranged are the Trump deranged? Are the deep state leakers and the Democratic media mouthpieces so blinded by their hatred for the president that they will go to treasonous links just to deny him a victory? Or are they simply hell-bent on provoking a full-scale war with Iran? CNN's exclusive report of a leaked top-secret U.S. intelligence assessment from the Defense Intelligence Agency on Tuesday suggested that the weekend B-2 bunker buster sortie in Iran was a flaw. This conveniently contradicted Trump's claim that it was a spectacular military success that had completely and totally obliterated Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities and overshadowed the startling good news that the president had somehow pulled off a ceasefire between Iran and Israel, which was still holding more than 40 hours later when we went to press. And as I'm speaking this, I think it's still holding. If the aim of CNN and its toxic leakers was to enrage Trump, it worked. But the president venting ever since on social media, on Air Force One to the traveling press corps, and in a press conference in The Hague, where he called CNN fake news. He has a point. Among the intelligence community, regard for DIA analysis is so low that the nickname for the agency is Do It Again. The CNN exclusive was written by none other than Natasha Bertrand, the same CIA stenographer who scooped the dishonest Dirty 51 letter by 51 former intelligence officials back in October 2020, falsely claiming that Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation. More on her later. And I'm not sure we'll get to that, so I'll get that article title again in a few minutes. The next section is entitled Dishonest Spin. The FBI is hot on the trail of the leaker, or leakers, of the DIA report, with U.S. Special Middle East Envoy Steve Witkoff accusing CNN's anonymous deep state sources of treason. But CNN's dishonest spin of the intelligence assessment was just as egregious. The DIA came out later to say it was a preliminary low-confidence assessment done in the early hours after the strike, and that the analysis was so equivocal, it said the impact of the strikes could be limited or could be very severe, as Trump told reporters at The Hague Wednesday. CNN just ignored the uncertain nature of the DIA findings and failed to report the contradictory assessments within the report that suggested Trump was right. But never mind. CNN's misleading reporting, soon amplified by the New York Times, gave the rest of the resistance media hours of gleeful raining on Trump's parade. God forbid that their audience consider Trump might be a step closer to achieving the ever-elusive peace in the Middle East. The same negative noise now chortling that boastful Trump had failed to set back Iran's nuclear ambitions more than a couple of months, were claiming last week that the president was exaggerating the threat because Iran was nowhere near getting nuclear capability. can't make up their minds because they don't have any thoughts of their own, other than whatever Trump says they're against. Within a day, the CIA, the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission, and even Iranian assessments contradicted the CNN story with battlefield assessments involving actual on-the-ground human and signal intelligence from Iran to say the U.S. strike on Iran's underground Fort Dow nuclear plant was quote-unquote devastating. Iran's foreign ministry admitted its nuclear sites were, quote, badly damaged, unquote. Well, there's a great deal more to this, and if you want to read the whole thing, I see our time is drawing to a close. I won't have time to read it all, but this was from the New York Post by Miranda Devine, entitled, Trump Derangement Syndrome Drives Deep State Leakers, CNN. The treasonous lines to deny Prez a victory. And again, the date of publication was June 25th, 2025. Well, we're not going to have time to read a couple of other good things. Perhaps next week, we'll see what news we have in the coming week. One little headline that looked pretty intriguing, and I'll read that if time permits next week, was, look, Minnesota Capitol, in its Capitol building, displayed a Satanist thank you plaque for Governor Tim Walz. Another headline, Noah's Ark sites, fully preserved secrets discovered in radar scans. Not what you'd expect to see. It was an older headline being requoted, David Wilkerson, global economic collapse begins in Germany. And a much older one, but still of importance, is kind of ties in with what I read earlier. Jewish students walk out after MIT commencement speaker accuses the University of Aden Israel's genocide. Well, thank you for listening. We haven't had many contributions lately. If you could help us out, it would be much appreciated. You can write to me, Luke Haberly, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. That's Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week.